Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, my name is Gary Mansfield, and this is the Ministry of Arts podcast, where each week I'll be speaking to a different artist. Now let's begin by bagging these bongos.
Yeah, right. Crazy.
Hello, here we are at episode 186. 186, how about that? So we're fast approaching episode 200. If you think we should celebrate it with a special guest, and you've got any ideas on who you might like, drop us a line on Instagram, at ministryofarts.org. I'll take a look and do my best to try and get hold of them. And this time, it's definitely not going to be me, which is how we celebrated episode 100. It was funny, it was interesting, it was even sad in places, but it did push my editing know-how to the limits. So yeah, drop us a line with any ideas. But anyway, back to episode 186. Today, I'm taking you to meet Adam Bridgeland. I've known Adam for several years now. He's a studio manager at Good Old Jealous Gallery in London. On paper, I'm sure you'd call him a printmaker who predominantly uses text in his artwork. But more recently, that text is taking a new form on different materials. One of his public text pieces is part of the Kensington and Chelsea Art Week, which we talk about in this episode. So if you happen to be in the Kensington and Chelsea area, go over to Kensington and Chelsea Art Week's Instagram page, which is KCAW London, and you'll be able to find out where Adam's artwork is situated, along with all the others on the Art Week. But rather than me telling you all about Adam and his work, come and hear it from the man himself. At this point, I'm going to throw in this little bit of audio, which may well sound different from what you've listened to already. But during this podcast, at some point, there will be an added piece of audio. That is because the piece in question that Adam has put into the Kensington and Chelsea Art Trail hadn't come to fruition when we first recorded the podcast. It has since. So I've just this minute had a quick Zoom call to get a little bit of information from Adam about this artwork. Adam was at work, so the quietest place he had to record was up on the roof of Jealous. So it's going to sound a little different, but there you go. Enjoy.
Yeah, no, they're about 2 meters long, the signs. The reason they were made at that size originally was because I'm pretty stubborn when it comes down to asking for help.
Oh, so, man, I'm the same. It really holds you back, doesn't it?
Yeah, so the only reason they're that size is because, well, two reasons. It sounds so mundane, but when you're thinking about things like this, is one, they can fit in my car, and two, I can install it. I can on my own if I really, really want to. A couple here were installed last year for First Light Festival.
Nice.
I think one might be going down into London next week or a week after, but we're currently talking about permits and blah blah at the moment, which is always the most, you know,
it's always fun, isn't it? I sat and watched MTech installing an artwork the other week.
Unbelievable, they are. Yeah.
They're fucking great, aren't they?
Yeah. I mean, they used to do a lot of stuff because on my journey as an artist or in my art career, I worked for Tate for a long time, installing. Oh, nice. So M-Tech were often brought in to do the heavy
lifting. The grown-up stuff.
I'm sure they did the one of the most impressive installs I saw at Tate Britain was they did, do you remember Fiona Banner put the planes in the Davine galleries? You
know, that was brilliant, wasn't it?
Yeah, I'm sure they did that. I'm sure they did that, and that was just unbelievable. It was. We weren't allowed to touch heavy machinery like that. We weren't qualified enough. I mean, we were just given is a ratchet screwdriver and put some work up on the ball. All right.
Yeah.
You hurt your nails, you will.
Because one of those aeroplanes was just standing on the tip, wasn't it?
Amazing. Unbelievable.
And I'm quite sure that she had them melted down and made into ingots.
That I don't know. That I don't know about.
Because I think I went to that was then the Gerwood Gallery in Hastings. And I walked in and there was on a pallet was a load of these aluminium ingots.
And you think they're the planes?
And I'm sure I read that they were the planes because I was quite impressed that I witnessed the two big aeroplanes. And then I'm witnessing them again in a different form. I thought it was amazing.
Well, I know. I mean, we did the Roger Heon's install as well for the Turner Prize when he took the plane and then he kind of chopped it down into dust.
Yeah.
And then that was scattered across the gallery. I remember doing that as well, but I didn't realise about Fiona's. Yeah, Tate was, you know, sorry, I didn't mean to start talking about...
No, that probably is the journey, isn't it?
I mean, going back to Tate, it's amazing how that job, for me, probably influenced a lot of what I do in terms of the care. I know it sounds, you know, the care in which I take when it comes down to presentation of works, because that's something that you just don't think about when you're at art school. You just make things, don't you? You just throw it out. But actually working at Tate, it kind of really gave me a kind of understanding of how to present, how to make things, you know, able to display them essentially.
Yeah.
You know, it's such an important part of things, you know, like the business side of things, you know, that you just don't get taught like that at art school. You learn it and that's what happens. But anyway, enough about my previous employments. I could talk about my celery packing factory.
But how long was you at the Tate for?
Tate, I remember 2006. So when I left, so basically since I left Royal College in 2006, I've always been freelance, you know, and I remember it was a degree show at the Royal College and they were looking for freelance art handlers at the Tate. And my wife said to me, you've got to get a job just in case the art doesn't pay. And I was like, oh, come on, I've got so much to do, love. I've got you know, five prints to make. Or, you know how it's like. and she goes, just shut up and do it. Yeah, come on, just get it done. Anyway, I'll help you. Anyway, she did. She helped me do, you know, the CV. And I'm forever, you know, thankful for that because I'd have never done it. Probably wouldn't have got the job. But yeah, I stayed there until 2013, 2014, basically when my art career, Jealous, has really taken off. And also Tate, it kind of run its journey. A lot of, you know, Tate's a kind of breeding ground for training really good techs and then them going on to another role. So the kind of school of techs that I joined with had gone off to Howser and Worth, Courtauld, Hayward, and all that to get, you know, head tech roles. And so I think 2013, last job I did was the Damien Hirst retrospective. And that was just weird because he brought his own people in anyway to install. So we didn't really do anything.
Yeah.
So, but I kind of just was like, it was that kind of, you know, the journey had kind of come to its end, but it was 6-7 years. It just played a brilliant team. And it's just a, you know, if I was telling anybody to get a job out of art school, go and work for Tate. They're a superb organisation.
Well,
I loved it.
What I can imagine that does do for you, which took me a long time to realise, it makes you sort of realise what's achievable.
Yeah, definitely.
Because as an artist, you're just working a couple of artworks in front mentally, aren't you?
Yeah.
You know, and then you can go, well, I can do this bigger because I've seen it being done. You know, it doesn't cost 50 grand to put this exhibition on, it can be done in 5, you know.
No, it's great. I mean, yeah, like I said, we just worked with some great Peter Doig exhibition. It was a Britain, that was amazing. That was, you know, it was just a properly good time. But I think I learned early on, again, going back to the fact that when I left Royal College, it kind of went freelance. I realized you could juggle jobs. That's the thing I realized early on. You could have a career where you could, I'll do my art, but I'll also do bit of teaching, I'll do a bit of work here, a bit of work there, and you're building all that up. And I suppose it's only recently where, you know, we'll come on to Jealous and my art career and blah, blah, and how we that merges and kind of intertwines. But it's only in the last few years that it's really got to a point where I've got to go, I can't do that. But when you're starting off, just you can't be precious about what you do. You've got to make a living. You've got to make money to make time to make your art. That's basically what you've got to do. And that's what we did. I did jobs to then give me the time to then make work, to then do what I trained to do, which is be an artist.
Well, if I can just put the handbrake on this conversation a sec and just mention that I have 7 questions that I ask each artist.
Yep.
And the first being, how would you explain what you do to someone that doesn't know your work?
I'm an artist who predominantly uses printmaking, probably. That's probably the best way of describing me. Yeah. But I think that a lot of people label me a printmaker because, one, I work for Jealous. 2, I trained as a printmaker. But the only reason I trained as a printmaker is because my foundation course, when I was doing it, I was a painter. And the teacher there said, you paint like you're a printmaker.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, okay, what do you mean? He goes, well, the repetition. It's, you know, have you ever looked at screen? And I was like, you know, New Warhol, I knew Lichtenstein, you know, Jasper Johns, all of those people. That was what spoke to me as a young artist in my foundation. And I looked at, you know, I just did screen printing for the first time when I was at, you know, foundation. And it just grabbed me. The fact that you could take something, put it onto a screen and then replicate it. The way I've kind of developed is, I mean, it's an in-joke at the studio, is that I'm probably the most qualified if you look at what...
yeah.
You look at a piece of paper and what I've done. I'm a master of arts, apparently. Apparently I am. But at Royal College, they didn't teach me how to print properly. Yeah. I took what they had there to use it for my art program. So anybody coming into Jealous and going, oh, we need a 30-colour print. There's no point in talking to me. You'll be lucky if you get 2 out of me if they're in register, right?
Yeah.
But that's why there's unbelievable people there working, because I didn't do that. I didn't train to do that. And that's the thing. So I think that I use a lot of printmaking, do a lot of sculpture. The multiple interests me. But also when we're doing additions, I like the fact that it's an addition, but I can hand finish it. So each one is slightly different. So it becomes unique in its own way. So I like the fact that there's something that exists, but everything is slightly different. I know that people were like, I don't like that. But for me, that makes it exciting. If I was just doing the same thing, I'm not sure if it would talk to me as much. But that's me in a nutshell. I just kind of go from project to project, making work that interests me, and I hope that some people latch on and enjoy what I'm doing too. I mean, the last 3-4 years have been amazing. But I think, you know, you build up, you take little things, and it goes like that, your career, doesn't it? And you celebrate what goes up there, and, you know,
try and forget what goes down there.
Forget what's going down there. But I've been very lucky. In the jobs I've been given. And I think, but again, going back to what we were talking about, jobs, I've always looked at those jobs as informing my practice as well. Yes, there's things that I've done which, you know, you throw away, but most of the things I've done, I've been very lucky in getting those jobs, working for some very, very good people. And I think that has helped inform my practice too.
Did you have creativity in home growing up?
Mum and dad weren't, really. Dad worked for the NFU as an insurance manager, and my mum worked at home. She did. The only person I can remember who had creativity was my granddad. And I remember, not massively, but I just remember him sitting down. Going back to planes, I remember him sitting down and showing me an easy way to draw a biplane. And I remember that. But that's the only thing that I remember.
Really. So where did your journey start then, do you think?
I mean, as a kid, I loved drawing planes, racing cars and birds. Brilliant. That was the first 3 things. And fight scenes. Every kid loves a fight scene. My youngest draws massacres on a grand scale, you know. But those are the 4 things. And I just remember it just being really excited by drawing and excited by creating. Drawing, really. In terms of making sculptures and multiples, it wasn't like at 12 years old I was out making huge things, but yeah, drawing's what grabbed me. And then I think that probably the secondary school teacher my aunt's secondary school teacher probably nurtured something that was there. I know that he was quite a, I mean, a lot of people were frightened of him, but he, for me, I just got him. He got me, and he was brilliant. A guy called Mr. McPherson, brilliant man. And he just, I think he nurtured that. And I think it's something I see now, and I complain a lot about, but I don't think there's enough art in education. But I think that without those teachers, I probably wouldn't have gone into an art career. But they saw something, and they kind of gave it an exciting edge, and that developed into what you know, going to art school and blah, blah, blah.
Well, most kids at that age who have got a creative ability, they just see it as something they enjoy doing. They don't realise that there could be more to their doodle or to their, you know, to their painting. When you have a teacher like that showing you there are possibilities, then that's when you sort of pick your chin up a little bit and sort of have a look around, isn't it, you know?
I think the one thing I will say is my mum and dad were very good at taking us to museums and taking us to collections, art collections and things. I remember my mum being really interested by the Bloomsbury Group, you know, Charleston and things. And maybe that's affected the way I work with objects, is because, I did love the way they just painted everything, you know, like the cupboard, let's just paint it.
Yeah.
You know, and I think, but, you know, I remember them taking me to a lot of those and the Fitzwilliam, you know, I grew up around Cambridge, so we went to the Fitzwilliam a lot, Kettle's Yard a lot. And I remember seeing a Klaus Oldenburg exhibition when I was about 15. And that really affected me. That I was like, well, that's, you know, where does that go? You know, how's he got to that point? And so I think that, you know, going back to what my mum and dad, you know, saying they weren't creative, I think they probably were in taking me to collections and a museum, which is, again, very important. You don't think of it at the time. You think, you know, but it goes in, doesn't it? And it
I never, you know, never that? Done that as a child, not at all.
So I think I've got, you know, I have to say that I'm thankful for that. I mean, and also my love of planes. My nan used to take me. She used to live in Mill Hill. So my nan used to, you know, we used to go down and spend.
Yeah.
And she'd go, where do you want to go? Okay. Hendon, RAF Museum. What? You went there last week. No, I want to go again. And so that's probably infected, again. I don't know.
And has that carried on through to today, your interest in planes?
I'm still the kind of person who looks at a sky and points at a plane. I mean, I must look so simple, but it's like, it's a plane.
Still standing there.
I'm fascinated by flight. I'm scared of flying. That's the main thing. I have to get on a plane. I get on a plane. I'm absolutely terrified. People would talk to you about the fact that I take a stone with me and I rub it as a worry stone. I mean, I lose pints of sweat. I mean, I remember, Jennifer, we all went out to LA to do the Charmin Baker show in 2013.
Brilliant.
And it's the first time that anybody really had flown with me in there. And I said, listen, I wouldn't sit near me because I am terrible. And everyone going, oh, we'll take the piss out of him. It's like that. Generally, as soon as they saw me on the plane panicking with me stone, right, and things, they genuinely felt sorry. And everyone now is just like, do not attack Adam. But I know I have to do it. That's the thing. It's one of those things that, I know I have to fly to see the world and to be able to do things I do. And so it's one of those things that I have to train for weeks. It's unbelievable.
I don't think you should knock it, because when you look at what it is everyone's doing, there's several hundred tons, several thousand feet in the air.
I know. It's
by rights, everyone should be in that state.
But the thing is, I think it's a control thing. Again, going back to the idea, you know, we're talking about the sign, putting that up, and why you make it a certain size, it's a control thing. If I was flying that plane, I wouldn't have a problem. I'd go, let's go, crack on. I'm still fascinated by things like that. I'm fascinated by speed, you know, all sorts of things. Anything shiny metal. And I mean, I think it's probably the library as well, but kind of the graphics and things. Because if you look at the artwork and you see the motifs within my work, you know, I love, you know, graphic art, the targets, the kind of the logos, you know, they all speak to me. And I suppose that's, again, a product of my childhood, you know, going and looking at planes and going and looking at motor racing cars and things like that. You know, they were big and bright and shiny. And again, that you take that in, and that influences what you do.
And ironically, anything that sort of makes your eyes open when you see that.
Yeah, definitely.
And when did you decide that you wanted to be an artist, or when did you think that art could be a part of you?
Probably, quite early on, I think, 16, probably 15, 16, probably. I dabbled with thinking about I could be a historian for a little while.
Nice.
But yeah, I think quite early on, I mean, it kind of just came about. I mean, I just kind of kept on doing it and people kept on giving me opportunities. And I think that you snowballed from that, really.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what else I would have done. I mean, maybe I'd have been... I got offered a job as a secretary once at occupational therapy at a hospital. Didn't want that. I remember that I did temping for a while and they thought I was okay at organising, which I am. I'm all right. But yeah, that didn't happen. but yeah, I think I did. Yeah, just people just gave me opportunities and it's kind of snowballed. And that's why I went, you know, going back to the point about I think I've been very lucky in I think I got my head screwed on. I think that people think that I'm quite level headed in terms of and I, when I've been given responsibility, I've taken it. And I think that probably speaks a lot when it comes down to decision making and giving people opportunities.
Well, you mentioned a couple of times about working for Jealous or working with Jealous. And through some of the time that I've spent with Jealous, sort of behind the scenes, as it were, getting to know people from everywhere, it's a bloody gorgeous family to be a part of, isn't it?
Well, yeah, family's the most important name with Jealous. I mean, I feel incredibly lucky to sort of found it in a way because it came out of nowhere. So I met Dario in 2008. And that was only because we used the same framer.
Brilliant.
And we used the same framer up in just by Finsbury Parkway, that way.
Yeah.
A lady called Rebecca. And she'd said, this Italian man wants to meet you. He likes your work and he wants to discuss, he's got an idea of opening this gallery up. And at that time, I was working Tate, but I was also working at the Royal College, doing 1-2 days a week there, managing their publications. And I'd really enjoyed that, but it wasn't more work available. So I thought, I'll go and meet him for a coffee. I will. And I thought, look, Jealous. Sounds a bit like a hairdresser's clothing brand. I'm not sure about that. Anyway, let's go and meet him, see what he's like. Anyway, he's infectious. You've met Dario. He's infectious.
He's amazing, isn't he?
And his energy, he's bubbly. And we just seem to hit it off. I think that I like what he was suggesting. And but to be honest with you, when I started, I remember my role was slightly different. My role was, coming in, installing shows, maybe bringing some artists, like an artist liaison type thing, bring artists like that. And that was it. I wasn't as involved, let's say, but I was there from the start. Matthew was there, printer, really good printer. And then Jess came on board just after me. There was another girl called Ellie. I'm not sure if you met Ellie.
She left
2012, 2013. But that was a core team. And it developed from that. And Crouch End, we had one screen bed, one digital printer, and that was it for many, many years. And it just seems to struggle. And we cannot underemphasize the impact of Charming Baker as well. I mean, without Baker, yeah. I think that we would have done all right, but that really catapulted us up the grade, so to speak. And then I think around about 2010, 2011, I think I said to Dario, why don't I manage the studio? Because we never had that structure. Matthew was kind of doing it all. And I think that it had got a bit too much in terms of printing all the jobs and just doing all, you know, the coordination of, because we'd also taken, on more printers at that point as well. So that's where I took the job and I took them. And that's been like that for the last 11, 12 years. I've been managing the studio. But what's beautiful about the studio is we rarely change. Two or three people have maybe left in 12, 13 years.
Brilliant.
And it is a little family. You know, I think that we just get on and we understand each other. And I think what also helps is, with the exception of maybe one, two maybe, we're all creatives.
Yeah.
As well. So that helps. And so we bounce ideas off each other. We have our own careers retrospectively and what's going to happen. We also can work with the artists and sometimes we say, well, why don't you try this way?
Yeah.
And then that might go take the things somewhere else and things. So I think that, I think I'm very lucky. I think I'm very lucky. And I think that, I mean, I don't know. You know, this is a big thing. I don't have a contact with Jealous. I don't. I just work for them. And I've worked for them for 12 years without a contract. And that says something about the bond between the studio and Jealous and me. I feel very strongly about that place and our position within the print world. I feel that we kind of came out of nowhere, really, but we've shaped a lot of people's opinions about what print and what a studio can be. And that's partly, you know, I feel that I'm a small part of that, but that's partly, you know, I think Dario's energy and all the rest of the team, and the gallery front of house, you know, the fact that we've got a front of house is very important as well. You know, not a lot of print studios have that. Print studios are, you know, in warehouses or whatever, in studios, but they don't generally have a front of house. Maybe they come to an art fair or two, but we are always there. You know, yeah. We're open. You can come see the tour, you can come and see the buzz of the studio. And I think that's really, really important. I do.
And putting on the shows for the artists there as well. Yeah. The gallery has become as well known as the studios upstairs now, hasn't it?
Well, I think the gallery is probably more well known than the studios, if I'm honest. I mean, I think the number of people who go, so there's a studio there. So those three floors upstairs, you make prints up there. And they've been to the gallery, what, 10, 15 times?
Yeah.
So I think that the gallery, because it's of where it is in Shoreditch, people probably know that more than the studio. And then when you peel back and then go, oh, a studio set, and you go for that tour and you see the buzz of, you know, 10, 15 people working, running around doing all these various projects, these amazing artists, you kind of, it's a bit mind-blowing, really.
Well, one of my favourite exhibitions was at Jealous, and that was Charming Bakers, when there was that ribbon of two prints going all around the gallery, and the airplane was just from pretty much from corner to corner in the gallery. I thought it was absolutely amazing.
Yeah, Dario tried that with a dinosaur again last year as well, didn't he?
I didn't see that one.
No, I mean, I think, you know, we've always tried to push, you know, people's perceptions of what's possible and have a bit of fun. At the end of the day, have a bit of fun. People connect to having fun, you know. But the thing is, we back it up with being serious and being good at what we do. And that's the thing. I think you can have a joke and you can do that, but, we know we can make good work. And I think that backs us up. So, yeah, long may it continue. I didn't think I'd be here for 14 years. I didn't think that would happen. But, I'm here and I'm loving it.
So you're part of its fabric.
Well, that's the thing. That's, you know, and that, you know, but giving it full circle here, that's why it's a family. Because it feels like a family in that respect. And, you know, and it's continuing to go like that at the moment. And we work with, you know, like I said, really exciting artists, both established and emerging ones. You know, we've always wanted to work with people coming out of art school, you know, on that beginning of a journey as well, because you never know where it's going to take you. You don't know where it's going to take you.
Yeah. Well, your own artwork has taken off over the last few years. I mean, not that it hadn't done before, but it's been a bit more prominent over the last few years, hasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I think, but I mean, I'm not going to lie. I think the pandemic was terrible for a lot of reasons, but one of the reasons, it was good for me. I mean, I think that people spent a little bit more time and looked and kind of discovered what I was about. I mean, I still don't know why. Maybe it was my time for people to start taking some notice. I don't know. I mean, my previous work was very graphic, you know, in terms of very clean lines. And I mean, you can see it behind. There's an old enamel patch up there.
There's
another piece I did there for Peacock. And both, you know, I really love those pieces of work we did. But I wonder... One thing I've wondered is, I wondered when the pandemic hit, I started hand painting the text. I finally felt confident about painting my own text. In the past, it's always been image and text, and it plays off each other, and there's always a subversive meaning, yada, yada, yada. But it's very clean. And I wondered whether people connected more to this kind of more
painterly.
Possibly. Possibly. Yeah. But I wish I could say to you, I know exactly why it was, but I don't. But I know that for some reason, the phrases and the way they were created and the way they were on found ephemera and how all those things mixed together, that connected much better.
So for anyone that hasn't seen your work, quite often you use quite poetic phrases. I presume they're your own poetic phrases.
Yeah, my own phrases. They can sit around for years, they can, and I'm not. And not be used, and then suddenly they'll get right. I mean, the ones that, you know, I need this woodness for my heart to beat, doesn't really do. You know, it does exactly what it says on the tin. Go and put it in a landscape, it works. You know, I try and do things that people will relate to, and then, but I also want with my artwork, I want people to look at them. You know, if it might be the image at the back, there's a subversion there. So, you've got a surface there and you look, oh, that's nice. That's nice. And but if you think about it a bit more deeply, maybe it takes you somewhere else. And that's what I've always wanted to do with my work, because I think that, I think artwork has the power to do that.
Those poetic phrases, they're not sort of, I'm not talking about like life affirming phrases. They're more to sit and make you reflect, aren't they? You know?
I mean, I think they're quite cathartic as well in terms of, you know, I get high and I get low, you know, in terms of moods and things. I think a lot of the phrases are probably connected in personally to how I feel at the time as well. Going back to the, you know, the signs here in terms of the text, I mean, they look like wooden pieces of wood with text in them at the moment. You know, they're not anything special, but what the real star of those pieces is a landscape. It's because when I install that, I know that there'll never be a say, it will never look the same at any moment.
No.
Do you know what I mean? It'll, you know, you could look at that sign in landscape and go, oh, okay, got that. And then 2 minutes later, you turn, it's different. And that's what I love about that. It's a it's a moving artwork in a way. Yes, the text is placed there, but actually the superstar is the landscape around it.
And all and for those that are listening, sorry, Ed, that what you're talking about is a wooden sign, 2 meters long, maybe 300 or 400 mil high, and the text has been cut out.
So that
when it's in the landscape, the text is whatever's behind it, normally the sky.
Yeah, sky, or, you know, we've done the one we did in Business Society, and that's got the east end of London. I mean, in the last year or two, we have got bigger with the signs. So we did the one on Lowestoft Beach for First Light Festival.
Yeah,
that was 13 and a half metres long.
Nice.
And that was, you know, it was, we had to get a team in for that. And we've done a couple of bigger ones, just because you know, where do you go after you've done the smaller ones? Always go bigger. Every artist goes bigger.
And was that the 13 metre one? Was that wood or was it?
Yeah, wood. It's marine ply. I like the way the marine ply kind of sits in the landscape after time. Now, all of these things are genuinely temporary pieces. So a lot of them time, they're only supposed to be there 3 or 4 weeks to cover for an exhibition or whatever.
Yeah.
But generally what happens is they stay and they start to, not decay is the wrong word, but they kind of start to kind of sit within the landscape. So, for example, we did one on Felixstowe Beach, right at the entrance of the Deben or the Deben River.
Yeah.
And it was it was only supposed to be there for 5-6 weeks. It stayed there for 4 years.
Brilliant. Is it still there now?
No. The only thing that took it down was the council took it down because they needed to move some shingle on the beach.
Oh, wow. Okay.
What I love the fact was that this marine ply had survived storms, salty water, blah, blah. And the only thing that destroyed it or took it down was the human hand. And it's the same, you know, I've just finished my first Core 10 steel one. So my first permanent one. So that was the one outside the Business and Design Centre in London. And that, again, that stayed for, 30th anniversary of London Art Fair, 2018? So yeah, 4 years. And it was only in Storm Eunice that it started to wobble. And we were like, right, let's get a permanent one and do it. But I like the fact, they're influenced by, you know, when you go to the harbours and the seaside and you see the signs advertising ferry trips and advertising fish for sale and, you know, all those sorts of things when you're walking around. And they're very handmade and they're very aesthetically of a place, yeah? And that's what they are. I make them out of the same material.
Yeah.
But, you know, but allows them to weather nicely. I mean, the Felixstowe one was unbelievable. It had salt crystals on it when it went, because it had just been there and it just been covered by salt and the mist from the sea.
Is there any way you can enhance that by putting a material on there?
I've never tried. I'm sure if I looked into it, but I quite like the idea that it ages and it kind of sits within the landscape and kind of eventually again. Again, that's why I was slightly disappointed about the Felixstowe one, because I wanted it, I wanted the North Sea to take it. I mean, it was done with an arts project team called Peer Projects. And we were supposed to have in the middle of Felixstowe, and the council got a little bit nervous. And so generally, like a lot of projects, they start moving you away from people because they're worried that they might get complaints. So
that's,
it went
that's
out.
That's the trouble with bureaucracy, isn't it?
Yeah. So when it went, but it was in a beautiful place right outside, opposite this Martello Tower. But I knew that we found a kind of quite a solid bit of a beach. It was dug into the beach, but because it had vegetation, and I thought it can't move that much.
Yeah.
But there was still a little part of me was hoping big old storm comes over, takes it out, off it goes to Holland.
Yeah.
It never happened, unfortunately. But next one. I'll build it closer to the sea next time.
Which piece that you've created do you reckon has got the strongest emotional connection?
For most people, I think it's probably I Need This Wilderness From My Heart To Beat. That's the one that seems to get most people. Personally, I created a piece, an older piece, which says, "While We Have This Moment, Say Something Cinematic." And that was a piece which had a deck chair in the middle of it, little patch piece, which that for me said everything about my artwork, kind of like this romantic, poetic notion, plus this very kind of quirky English, you know, deck chair kind of setting, you know, because there's nothing romantic about a deck chair. There's nothing romantic about sitting next to somebody and saying something nice, and then because you look like an arsehole getting off deck chairs, you know, you're going to roll out, don't you? And I think that that's, you know, there's something, you know, inherently human about my work is the fact that I'm looking at real life situations and how even in the mundane, there's something romantic sometimes. So for me, that's the one that speaks to me the most, and that's the one I was most proud of. But in terms of what the reaction from people is, probably I Need This Wilderness From My Heart To Be.
Yeah.
Wake Up Next To People Who Make You Feel Happy gets a lot of reaction recently. But I quite like the fact that everyone who speaks to me about it thinks it's about waking up with multiple people rather than one person, which I quite like. I quite like the fact that they were like, yeah, here, seven people here in my bed.
That's the beauty anyway, isn't it?
Yeah.
Whatever leaves the artist's studio then becomes a property.
Exactly. Well, there's an ambiguity to it, isn't it? You know what I mean? So it's kind of like, I like the fact that people will put their own meanings on it. And that's what you want from an artwork. You don't, you want people to latch onto it. Once it leaves your studio, you know, it becomes them. It becomes their piece of work, really, doesn't it? And that's what you hope with an artwork. It's like a song. You know, you write a song, don't you? Everybody has a different meaning to a song, doesn't it?
Well, saying that about songs and obviously words and the poetic phrases, the best love songs are normally made when you're at a low ebb.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
How about your phrases? Do you know what point of mental state you are when the best ones of those come out?
I don't know. I think I'm grumpy most of the time. No, I'm not kind of grumpy. I don't know. I mean, that's a really difficult question because I think you don't remember. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, no,
I mean,
sometimes
it can just be during a conversation.
Yeah, I think I get them from all places. I do. Yeah. I think like probably some have come out of being feeling a little bit low. But again, you know, you could also say it's they come when there's a pressure of a show or something, and you've got right, God, think of something. Come on. But again, like I said, some of it just comes, and I mean, I used to keep notebooks, but now it's my phone, and I write them down.
Yeah.
You know, that then I'll look back if I'm needing something for a show, and so I think they come from all sorts of places, really.
Yeah.
Lots of conversations with people as well. Friends will say something, and I'll go, "That's brilliant. How's that not?" You know, I'll write that down.
Yeah. I was just about to say, when I'm chatting with Ray Richardson, we would say something, and he would just grab his pen and write down a title for a future piece of work. It may never come about, but it's something that's within his sort of psyche, you know.
Ray's great. I remember him because he's friends with Mark Hampson.
That's it. You knew Mark from RCA, did you?
Yeah. So Ray was quite was around a lot when I was training. So we've worked with him a couple of times at Jealous, and it's kind of, again, it's very weird when somebody's been there when you're doing your kind of traineeship at art school. And then you're then making work for him at another thing. So it's kind of, he's a lovely chap, great bloke.
How cool is Mark?
Love Mark. Mark is, I always remember he's a straight talking, he is. That's what brilliant. I love about Mark. He's just kind of like, he doesn't suffer fools gladly, you know. No. He'll tell me if my work was terrible, you know, and I love that. You know, I work on the yes and no answers, right? I'm not a maybe man. I need a yes or a no. Yeah. And Mark fits into that bracket. He would tell me if something was crap, and he'd tell me if something was right. And I love that. And I think that, again, I think people, it's about the speed in which you get people. Some people can't deal with that. Some people can't deal. And yeah, listen, my ego takes a hit every time that somebody, you know, somebody says that's not very good. Is it also, you know, it's not something's not reacted to. Somebody told me years ago, if you can learn to accept the word no, you'll be fine as an artist.
Yeah.
Because if you don't let that eat up you up inside, you'll then snowball onto the things you get given. And I think that Mark helped me understand that as well. It's because, yes, he was straight talking. He talked to tell me how it was. And I go, all right, okay, fair enough. Oh, God, I can't believe he said that. But then actually you go, all right, he's helping me. if you can get back quickly as an artist and understand how people are actually telling you to do things and helping you in that way, then you'll learn quicker and move on.
And art school is the perfect place to understand that, because that's where the tutors would most easily say that that isn't working. And that's when you've got to put your ego down. Because when I was at art school, there was people who couldn't fucking, they thought that that bit of criticism was negative.
Yeah.
And they was going, oh, they've said this about my work, that about my work. And it's fucking creative, because they're saying, we're telling you that that's not quite working. Look at it and readjust.
Well, I got referred at the end of the first year, and I thought it was the end of the world. I thought that I was the best thing end of first year at Royal College. I thought, I'm here, I made it. Blah, blah, you know, it's all mapped out.
They're going to put a plaque on the wall with me name on it.
I thought that is, you know, I thought they had that on order. You know, but I think a lot of people think that when they go to the Royal College and things like that, and they RA and blah, blah.
Yeah.
And, you know. And I remember, well, you know, I was talking with Mark. Mark said, no, we need you to just alter slightly, change a little bit. I mean, I was devastated, pissed off. All my mates are outside in the park, drinking and having a good time, having picnics, and I'm still over a lifo bed and screen bed trying to mix it up with my artwork to try and get through to my second year.
Yeah.
But you know, when you're in that moment, you're like, what an arsehole.
Yeah, of course.
But I look back now, and actually thanks to Mark and the other teachers who did that, because it changed my work, and it pushed me to do something different and got me out of that mindset that I thought that I knew what I was doing, and actually no, it took me on this different path. And I think that's a big life lesson. And so again, I'll be very, you know, eternally grateful. Again, it's an example of a teacher affecting the way you look at life.
Yeah.
And again, he's another art teacher that pushed me to where I am today.
Brilliant. Have you ever seen anything about him online? Because he tries his fucking hardest not to be online.
Yeah, trying to find images of him. It's very
fucking hard work, but his work is fucking stunning, isn't it?
I mean, yeah, I mean, we've done, well, he was in the show that you did, wasn't he?
He was, and he worked over Ray's.
Yeah, that was it. Yeah, I just, you know what, I never actually considered that, but it is really hard to find. I love that. No, he's lovely. And I think that when he left to the Royal Academy, I think that the Royal College lost something. I think he really was good for the students and the well-being of the students. He cared for them and he pushed them. He did. And I think that sometimes you need someone who ruffles the feathers a little bit and says it like it is, because that's the only way you move forward sometimes. And if you can't handle it, or you can't process that, let's be a bit more PC. If you can't process that in a productive way, then I don't know if you can work within the arts, because I think that the arts is so subjective, objective, whatever you want to say. You know, people like it or they don't like it.
Yeah.
People can be in the middle, but you know, that's what's beautiful about being in the arts or being within a creative industry, is the fact that you have people who like it. You have people. I know that people don't really like my artwork. I know that people like my artwork, but it is what it is. You know what I mean? Yeah. You've got to move on and let, you know, and learn to live with it.
Looking at your own taste, you know, you don't like every type of music, you know.
No, definitely, exactly. And it's the same with art. You like certain things, you don't like other things. I'm not saying that I don't appreciate the craft within something.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is what it is. You move on.
Speaking of other artists, if there was you and five other artists, past and present, what would your ideal group show be?
God, that's a big question. Should have sent me that beforehand.
No, because it's good getting this reaction.
I mean, I'm going to sound really, really popularist and mainstream, I am, right? But I'm going to have Warhol there, because Warhol, without Warhol, I wouldn't be making work. I love everything about Warhol. And I know that people go, oh, I can't believe he said Warhol. But yeah, Warhol...
He's the most popular stated on this question.
Yeah. Warhol, without a doubt. Then it gets a bit more tricky. I'd probably have Cy Twombly.
Nice.
Jasper Johns, simply because I think that Jasper Johns, for me, when I was earlier on, in the way he makes his marks and the drawn marks, particularly his print making marks, I just for me, just spoke to me. Loved it.
Did you go to his RA show?
Yeah.
Amazing, wasn't it?
Yeah, I just think, and I spent years trying to, you know, he used to use Encaustic, you know, with the wax in the oil. Yeah. He spent years trying to recreate that in a different way, but it always looked like a Jasper Johns. Okay, God, dear me, it's such a difficult question. It really is. It wouldn't be an artist, but I'd probably throw in a printmaker or a print technician called Ken Tyler.
Nice.
Right. And Ken Tyler worked with all the great artists. So if you look him up, Ken Tyler, and he worked with Stella, Lichtenstein, Hockney, and he worked out his house in California, and he'd make these amazing prints. And the prints were just, they're just unbelievable. They are just really on really thick paper, embossings, and I think, yeah. So Ken Tyler would probably be there to kind of mix it up a little bit.
Brilliant.
Talk about his, you know, his favourite canapé or whatever. I don't know. and then finally, let's have a fifth person. It's so hard. It's so hard to think about who your final artist is, because I probably missed out so many people I think are absolutely brilliant. I'm going to have a look behind here on my art shelf. Need a photographer. Do you know what? Stephen Shaw. I'll throw Stephen Shaw in. I need somebody else to mix it up with the printmakers. So yeah, Stephen Shaw, and I'd ask him to bring a 35mm toy camera. he can take some lovely shots with that. He can.
And how about if you wasn't an artist, Adam? What do you reckon you'd like to be?
I'd probably work in history or something. Probably something along those lines. Archaeologist or something like that. Because I'm something like, I although I don't like digging that much, I'd be like pointing at things. Maybe dig there. Yeah. I got a feeling. but you know, I'd have probably something along those lines, I reckon. Obviously, I'd love to be a footballer. I love football as well. That's my other passion in life, and I still
playing
play
or
it.
Watching or both.
Oh, but both. I play every week. I do. You wouldn't believe it from my bodily shape, but hit up to the big man. I genuinely think I get so on a Wednesday night. So I'm a chairman of a local football club. That was too many Stellas, which my wife always reminds me of. But I took that on, and I love that. I genuinely love, you know, we're a growing club, and I love the fact that we give the opportunity for lots of children in the area to play. And also, there's a vets team, which I play for there, and we've got a men's team hopefully coming next year. And this is about development. Yeah. So I play every Wednesday. I do training.
Does it knock it out? Yeah.
The brain's still there. The legs haven't. I genuinely love it, and you know, we got season tickets to Cambridge United, and so me and the kids go up there, and my wife as well, we go up there every other Saturday. Nice. But I'm an Arsenal fan generally. That's my granddad's fault. He told me I was born late 70s, early 80s, and he supported Arsenal. He said, and all my mates were supporting Liverpool at that stage because they just won everything.
Yeah.
And he goes, you are not supporting Liverpool.
Good right. man.
Don't you dare. And so, you know, that's why I supported. That's why I'm.
And is this the granddad that was in Mill Hill?
No, this is that was a granddad actually out of Mill Hill. This is the one that taught me how to do biplanes.
Yeah.
My granddad who was in Mill Hill, I don't think he even liked football.
I thought you were going to say he didn't even like me then.
Well, I don't know. He might not have. But that granddad always remember because I can't pronounce my T and H's. They all sound like F's. Yeah. So he would always forever say to me, the rain in Spain falls mainly on the plane. The plane. And I still couldn't do it. I still, so when I used to write songs and you know, when I had bands and things, I try and avoid putting words which had THs in because I can't pronounce them.
Like the fellow of Fools and Horses, isn't it?
So, you know, you go, how much is that? Three. What? It's free. What, nothing, no, £3. But what? It's in my head. I honestly, even at 42 years old now, I still think about it. I'm like, TH, God, no. But again, I think that feeds in. I'm a bit dyslexic and things like that. And I think that's probably helped me in a weird way. I think that you learn to cope with or learn mechanisms to learn and move forward. And I think that probably, in a way, adds to your creativity. So, yeah, although I do think about the THs a lot, in other ways, it probably helped me. You know what I mean?
Of course. And this won't be coming out for probably till September or something. Have you got anything coming up?
What have I got coming up later in the year? I've got part of a group show in Amsterdam later on in the year. Working towards, so basically I'll work towards a solo show next year. Not sure when that will be, what it will be at the moment, but that, generally I like to try and have a solo show every other year.
Have you got the format of that in mind yet?
Not yet. Generally, it'll work. I'll panic about a month to go before.
Yeah, of course.
Anyway, but there's lots, lots of things, lots of kind of installed signs looking towards that at the moment. Some additions to be made for galleries and various things. Nothing concrete at the moment, but just busy with various bits and pieces. And then next year we'll do a show. I look to do a solo show, mix up a little bit, see where work is. I mean, that weird kind of moment, because I had the show at Jealous at the end of last year and it went very well. But then you kind of start to kind of question who you are as an artist and what you want to do. Because you obviously think, oh, I don't want to do the same there. I want to do something different. And then you go, what is different? And you go, I don't know what to do. And then I'm back stage at the moment.
Yeah. Different is unsure, isn't it?
Yeah, different is unsure. And I'm just waiting for that moment that you create something, you go, oh, that's got some legs.
Got something here, yeah.
Yeah, and that's where I'm at the moment. I'm making and I'm happy with what I'm making because it ticks boxes and it's right for what we need for the briefs of various things. But for me, for a show, I need to do something else. Do you know what I mean? To satisfy the urge as a practitioner. And I'm not there at the moment.
It's funny that, isn't it? As any creative, what you're saying there is you get comfortable when you find something that is working. You've done a lot of hard work to make your life easy. And then after a little while of it being easy, you think, this easy is a bit too easy. I need to sort of, as you say, ruffle it up a little bit.
The worst thing is, and one thing I don't want to do is I don't want to people to kind of go, he's a guy who just wrote, I need this wilderness on everything.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, again, that's one, you know, going back to that patch of it, I made a load of those and they did very well. People liked them. But for me, I don't want to be pigeonholed as, oh, he's the patch artist or he's the... For me, I want to be able to people to go back, yeah, do you know what? He mixed things up a little bit and he tried different things and some things.
Is, even the people that would say that, they're going to say that anyway. But if you've got loads of groups of people saying, oh, he does the patch, he does the poems, he does the eyes, you know, you've got loads of little groups who are identifying you, putting you in their own little pigeonhole.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's going to happen anyway.
Yeah. It's just, you know, it's one of those things, isn't it? In your head, you're just going to go, I want to. But we'll see. We'll see. We'll go to the next thing. Maybe eyes with text. I don't know. Who knows?
And Adam, where can anyone find you online, be it website or social media?
So my website, adambridgeland.co.uk, Instagram, adam_bridgeland. And then also you can look at various galleries I work with. So Jealous, obviously, Tag, Fine Arts, Peacock up in Aberdeen as well, Circle, Contemporary down in Cornwall. I've probably forgotten lots of other people. But yeah, if for people I've forgotten, look at my website and I list them there. I do.
Yeah, I do apologise.
I do apologise, but they're all wonderful people. I just, you know, putting on the spot. It's a bit like the dinner party thing. I your mind goes blank of artists.
Of course. You mentioned that you've got a piece in Kensington coming up. And as you may be aware, I've recorded with nearly every artist from the Kensington Chelsea Art Week this year, as I did last year. Could you tell us a bit about this artwork, where it is and what it's about?
Yes. it kind of came out of the blue. I knew it was going to, there was a potential that it might happen, and then it didn't happen, and then discussions just came out of the blue, and it happened very, very quickly, really. Not a lot of time to think about it. But we, the organisers of the Art Trail and Vistalia discussed with the possibility of what of a sign that would kind of connect, I don't know, the theme of this year and something that would connect to the area. And I felt that where it was going, which is kind of, it's right on the kind of Heathrow path, you know what I mean? You know, when you look up in the sky, it's that the activity all around that West London area is so.
Where is it precisely, Ed?
Yeah, so basically, it's in a great place actually. It's not a gyratory, but it's, you know, when you're coming down from White City,
yeah,
and you're coming down onto High Street Kensington, and then you're going to turn right down to Olympia. On that, it's not a roundabout. It's not really a gyratory, but it's got a kind of circular feel.
Yeah, I know the bit you mean.
And it's, if you're coming from White City, is that Holland Park Road, I think, and then going onto High Street Ken.
Yeah.
The sign is basically directly opposite that junction, and so it's great. And you're going into Warwick Gardens.
Nice.
And what I really, reason I really liked it. I mean, we looked at when we were installing it a week ago, we looked at two or three locations. But what I liked about that is it opens up, so you've got a good vista, which is important for the, as I've probably spoken to you about before, about getting the vista for these signs just right. And it's got, as you go into Warwick Gardens, it has this amazing, I mean, this palm tree or this, you know, it, and this kind of column. And it look, it could look like the south of France or something, you know, like and or kind of a Mediterranean kind of coastal town. And so, for me, that was the most interesting because you kind of, it, you know, it looks like it's just landed there in this urban, you know, noisy area. And I mean, I always remember that area because obviously all the art fairs we've done at the Olympia and then being at Royal College, that was kind of the far end of High Street, Kensington. And so, it kind of felt good going back to that area and creating something that people can kind of come and enjoy and enjoy the view against the text. It's just
And what is the artwork you've installed, Ed?
So it's called Look at the Sky as Everything is Alive.
Nice.
And I think that going back to what I was saying about how busy the skies are around there, you know, I think that that's it makes real sense, that connection between, because obviously that's where the work, you know, is it strongest, is when the sky is blue and you see these, you know, planes coming across and it goes clear skies with the stars as well. You know, there is, you know, that's the truth about it is, you know, look at the skies, everything is alive. You know, it's constantly moving, constantly changing. You know, it goes about that idea of, for me, you know, we talked about how these signs, they're never the same at any given time, you know, during the day or during the night. It always changes. It depends on when you look at them. It will always provide you with a different landscape to look against. And I think that this work is really strong and that message is really strong against with that idea.
Brilliant. I'll let you get back on with your day. Thank you very much for your time, mate.
No worries, buddy. I appreciate it. Sorry it's a bit late.
Oh, you're more than welcome.
And we'll catch up in person soon, all right? It'll be good to have a beer or something, yeah?
All right, me old mate. I'll speak soon.
Cheers, buddy. Cheers, mate. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Hello. I'm Vasalia Chilton, the director of Kensington and Chelsea Art Week and Art Trail. The artist you've just been listening to is part of the Kensington and Chelsea Art Week and Art Trail. The Art Trail starts on the 18th of June and ends on the 31st of August. You can find all the details on our website, kcaw.co.uk. Thank you so much for listening.
Well, hope you enjoyed that episode of the Ministry of Arts podcast. So we wasn't dictated to by advertisers, we decided from the offset to go ad-free, which means obviously we had to self-fund. So we set up the Ministry of Arts Patreon page. And without that support, we would not be able to produce this podcast. So if you like what you hear and you're able to support the podcast, just go over to the Ministry of Arts Instagram profile. You'll find a Linktree drop-down box, which will direct you straight to our Patreon page. And for the price of a cup of coffee, you can help keep us growing week by week. But if you're not able to do that, that's fine because this content is free for everyone. But leaving a review on whichever platform you listen to your podcast, that really does help us get noticed and anyone else looking for an art podcast. Or even giving us a positive shout out on your social media. Everything is appreciated. But either way, thanks for listening. And until next week, ta-da.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.